Iran says the Syrian army is capable of defeating terrorists, stressing that Tehran will continue to support Damascus in cooperation with resistance groups. And dozens more Palestinians are killed in Israel's indiscriminate air and artillery strikes across Gaza, as the genocidal war's death toll tops 44,400. Thanks for joining us. The Syrian army continues to pound terrorist gathering points and convoys in the northwestern part of the country, inflicting heavy casualties and losses on them. According to Syrian military, the country's forces, in cooperation with the Russian Air Force, targeted a gathering of terrorists near Al-Hamdaniya Stadium in the Aleppo Governorate. The strike left dozens of terrorists and their leaders dead and wounded. The Syrian forces and Russian warplanes also completely destroyed a convoy consisting of dozens of vehicles loaded with ammunition, equipment, and terrorists in the eastern part of Idlib. According to Syrian military, 320 terrorists have been killed and 63 pieces of military equipment destroyed in the provinces of Idlib, Hama, and Aleppo during the past 24 hours. The chief of the general staff of the army and armed forces directly supervised operations in Hama at the direct order of President Bashar al-Assad. Our correspondent in Damascus, Ibrahim Wahdi, says the Syrian army has redeployed its strategic forces to the north of Hama to mount an effective counteroffensive against terrorists.
The chief of the general staff of the army and armed forces made an important visit today to the northern countryside of Hama to check the front lines where the Syrian Arab army conducted a strategic redeployment there and fortified its position. Today, the Syrian Arab army, since yesterday night and today, the Syrian Arab army liberated more than 13 villages, including the strategic Qal'at al-Madif, the Madif Citadel, and Mardif. Also, the Syrian Arab army set several ambushes all the way from Hama northern countryside to Aleppo, and eliminated and captured dozens of terrorists. The Ministry of Defense also said today that the joint Russian and Syrian air forces conducted and carried out an important airstrike which targeted a terrorist convoy consisting of dozens of vehicles loaded with ammunition, terrorists, and it burned it all. It showed, it posted a video showing the convoy burned completely.
Iran's prime minister says Takfiri terrorist groups in Syria made a miscalculation by launching their ongoing assaults on the country's army positions. Abbas Araghchi was speaking upon his arrival in Turkey's capital after a visit to Syria. He said that terrorist groups believe that the Israeli aggression against Lebanon and Palestine has provided them with an opportunity to achieve their goals in Syria. Araghchi stressed that the Syrian army and government are capable of defeating terrorists, but Iran and resistance groups will offer any support that is necessary. Elaborating on his plans in Turkey, the minister said that he would have an extensive meeting with Turkey's foreign minister, Hakan Fidan, to discuss the two countries' common concerns. The top Iranian diplomat expressed hope that Tehran and Ankara would reach an understanding on regional issues that would lead to stability in the region and prevent Syria from becoming a hub for terrorists. Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi has traveled to the Syrian capital, Damascus, in an extraordinary visit where he met with President Bashar al-Assad to discuss the escalation of terrorist attacks in northern Syria. Correspondent Ibrahim Wahdi has more from Damascus.
Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi arrived in the Syrian capital, Damascus, on Sunday afternoon on an urgent visit after the recent developments in the Arab country. He was received at Damascus International Airport by an official delegation.
Throughout Syria's existential struggle against the Zionist entity and terrorism, we have stood side by side with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Today's visit by the Iranian foreign minister is part of our ongoing coordination and collaboration during this critical phase, as we are committed to victory alongside our friends, including Russians.
President Bashar al-Assad met with Araghchi and affirmed that the Syrian government, people and army will continue to fight with all firmness and determination to eradicate terrorism and eliminate it. Araghchi conveyed a message from the Iranian leadership confirming Iran's firm support for Syria in its fight against terrorism and its full readiness to provide all types of support, reiterating his country's commitment to the unity and stability of Syria.
This visit of the foreign minister of Iran is the visit in the exact time, and it came to assure to the all, to Syria first, and to all the people who don't trust that Iran is going to be exactly beside Syria in this war against the terrorism. And assure another thing, that this war is a part of the war of the Israelis against all the resistance all over the area, and Iran is going to be the beside of the Syrian people as it was the beside of the Lebanese or Palestinian people.
After his visit to Damascus, Araghchi will go to Ankara to discuss ways to find an acceptable solution to the current situation in Syria as part of Iran's diplomatic efforts. Analysts believe that the current diplomatic movement echoes the military situation on the ground, which will be determined by the Syrian Arab Army and its allies. While the world remains mute spectator to the resurgence of terrorism in Syria, Araghchi's visit comes at this critical time as part of Iran's diplomatic efforts to resolve the crisis in Syria and to reaffirm Tehran's unwavering support for Damascus. Ibrahim Wahdi, Damascus.
In the Iranian capital, Tehran, a heartfelt farewell has been held for Brigadier General Qomarspour Hashemi, a senior IRGC commander who was martyred in Syria. As Iran mourns this national hero, the ceremony underscores the nation's unwavering commitment to supporting Syria in its ongoing fight against foreign-backed terrorism. Gisumi Shahmadi has more.
A solemn ceremony to bid farewell to a national hero, a loss that underscores the continued sacrifices made by Iranian military advisors in the region as they maintain peace and stability in the face of threats from terrorist groups. Martyred in Aleppo last week, senior IRGC commander Brigadier General Qomarspour Hashemi played a vital role in assisting Syrian forces, serving as a military advisor.
Martyr Pour Hashemi was a brave and dedicated commander, a symbol of sacrifice. His martyrdom is a reminder of the unyielding commitment we have to support Syria in its struggle against foreign-backed terrorists. Despite these attacks, we remain resolute in our mission.
Martyr Pour Hashemi lost his life in Aleppo during a large-scale assault by foreign-backed terrorists targeting Syrian military positions. This attack, reportedly carried out by the Hayat Tahrir al-Sham group, marked a significant escalation in the ongoing conflict in Syria, making the fight against them and the presence of Iranian military advisors even more crucial. Martyr Pour Hashemi's son, feeling proud despite the loss.
I am grateful to God that my father achieved what he always wished for, to sacrifice his life in the righteous path. My father believed in defending the innocent and fighting terrorism wherever it existed. Losing him is painful, but I take great pride in knowing that his sacrifice has helped bring peace to many. I always remember how committed he was to the resistance. He was fighting for his country and for Syria, aiming for the region to be peaceful. His legacy will continue through the strength of the Iranian forces and the Syrian people.
General Pour Hashemi's martyrdom comes amid ongoing efforts by Iran to support Syria in its fight against terrorism. Since 2011, Iran has maintained an advisory mission in Syria at the request of the Syrian government. The Iranian military advisors have been instrumental in assisting Syrian forces reclaim territory and restore security.
Martyr Pour Hashemi was not only a great warrior, but also a true man. At a time when our enemies tried to weaken the resistance, he stood firm and sacrificed his life. His blood will not be in vain.
As the country mourns the loss of this brave commander, Iranians remain firm in their support for Syria, signaling that this tragedy will not deter their commitment to regional peace and security.
Martyr Qomarspour Hashem was not the first, and he will not be the last, as Iran remains steadfast in its support for Syria. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
More civilians have fallen victim to Israel's indiscriminate strikes across the Gaza Strip as the regime's genocidal war rages on unabated. One of the regime's latest attacks hit a house in Beit Lahia in northern Gaza, killing at least 10 civilians. 8 Palestinians also lost their lives in 2 Israeli airstrikes in Gaza City. the Al-Shati refugee camp, an Israeli drone targeted a group of citizens, killing one person and injuring several others. The regime's Sunday strikes killed at least 12 civilians, including a child, in the southern city of Khan Yunis. The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees has issued a stern warning about the dire humanitarian situation in the territory. According to UNRWA, over 400,000 displaced people are currently sheltering in the agency's schools, while hundreds of thousands more are struggling to survive in temporary shelters. The Israeli genocide in Gaza has claimed the lives of over 44,400 Palestinians so far, leaving over 105,000 others injured. Our Gaza correspondent Mutaba Masaba joined us earlier with more details on the latest Israeli strikes across the besieged Palestinian territory.
Let me begin with Gaza City, where as the Israeli warplanes carried out several attacks against gatherings of the Palestinian people. The major one was in Athawra Street in the western part of Gaza City, when the Israeli fighter drones attacked a gathering of the Palestinian people seeking for an access to the internet connection, killing at least six Palestinian civilians. In the meantime, several air raids were carried out against several residential buildings in Ansar and Al-Ghifari streets in the western part of Gaza City as well, leaving scores of the Palestinian casualties. And even when it comes to the southern part of Gaza City, basically Khan Yunis City, we are talking about at least 12 Palestinian dead bodies were transferred into, as you know, Ras Al Medical Complex in the western part of Khan Yunis City after the Israeli occupation forces carried out several drastic air raids against gatherings of the Palestinian people, killing six Palestinian civilians. In the meantime, the other ones actually were extracted from different parts of Rafah City. The current situation is still catastrophic for the Palestinian people in the southern part of Gaza Strip as a result of this constant and non-stop Israeli bombardments taking place left and center. And even when it comes to the northern Gaza Strip, as you know, the Israeli attacks are still the Israeli occupation forces are still attacking different parts of the northern Gaza Strip. We are talking about constant bombardments that are still ongoing and non-stop for more than 64 consecutive days.
The health ministry in Gaza has confirmed early reports that the Israeli regime is using internationally banned weapons against civilians in the blockaded territory. The ministry's director, Munir Al-Bursh, said eyewitnesses' testimonies indicate that the regime uses internationally prohibited weapons, which have caused the victims' bodies to be evaporated, especially in northern Gaza. He added that Israel's banned weapons caused special types of burns that have never been seen before, vaporizing entire bodies of those exposed to them. The official also called for an international investigation into the type of weapons used by Israel in its genocide in Gaza. His remarks came only a few days after the Hamas resistance movement reported the use of internationally prohibited arms by Israel. Group said it collected horrific testimonies from doctors and residents in northern Gaza, who recounted the evaporation of bodies after Israeli attacks. It also called for an international probe into the issue. We earlier asked political commentator Christopher Halali about Gaza's health ministry's report on the Israeli regime using internationally banned weapons against civilians in the besieged territory. Let's take a listen.
The Zionist military forces use prohibited weaponry, whether that's white phosphorus or other incendiary devices. These are munitions that have chemical compositions with the different elements, both naturally occurring or synthetic, that are highly flammable and even non-reactive to water and things like that. They'll continue to burn. And so some of these compounds, which are certainly prohibited because they cause severe wounds and they kill civilians, they have been used. I've seen some video clips online, unverified, but they show these munitions being used and the after effects. The body is being smothered in water and also in sand and dirt, and the body is still burning, which is clear that these munitions contain materials whose sole goal is to kill and cause as much damage and maim people.
Israel's former Minister of Military Affairs has once again stressed that the regime is committing war crimes in Gaza, especially in its north. In an interview with the Israeli media, Moshe Yaalon said hardliners in Netanyahu's far-right cabinet seek to remove Palestinians from northern Gaza and reestablish settlements there. Reiterating that war crimes are taking place in northern Gaza, he said that Israel is carrying out an ethnic cleansing operation there. Yaalon's comments echoed previous remarks that he made in an earlier interview, which he said due to Israel's ethnic cleansing campaign in Gaza, Beit Lahia and Beit Hanun do not exist anymore. Yaalon served as a military affairs minister under Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu from 2013 to 2016. Israeli forces and settlers continue their violent raids on Palestinian cities and towns across the occupied West Bank. In their latest incursion, the regime forces killed four Palestinians in the city of Jenin. Violent confrontations also erupted between Palestinian resistance fighters and the regime's forces in the village of Sir, southwest of Jenin, and also in the eastern areas of Nablus. Our Ramallah correspondent Naka Hamid joined us earlier with more details.
An Israeli drone performed an assassination, a direct assassination in Jenin, in specifically in the area of Sir, to four Palestinians who were inside a car, Muntasir Naim, Ismail Abu Rub, Wa'il Lahlouh, and Abdussalam Abu Rub were all assassinated in the area of Sir in the hours of the morning. Later, for the IOF to make an incursion to the area where the assassination happened, and closing it for many hours, for several hours, and then detaining the bodies of the four martyrs. Well, Jenin was not the only place where many raids and attacks has happened throughout the day in the West Bank. As you have just said, the IOF raided Nablus, and news and the local sources talk about an armed clash that is happening currently right now in the area, specifically in the area of Balata refugee camp in the eastern side of Nablus, where the main focus for the IOF, for the raiding IOF forces in the east side, specifically in the area of Yusuf's tomb, where IOF and groups of settlers have invaded the eastern part of Nablus, and as it's still going on.
The Yemeni army says it has carried out another retaliatory operation in nearby waters in response to the American-British aggression against the country. According to the army spokesman Yahya Sari, the new operation was carried out by Yemen's naval, drone, and missile forces. It targeted an American destroyer and three U.S. Navy supply ships with 16 ballistic and winged missiles and a drone in the Arabian Sea and the Gulf of Aden. Sari stressed that the Yemeni missiles and drones hit their targets with precision. The operation came after earlier in the day, Yemen's army said it had carried out a successful missile strike, hitting a vital target in Tel Aviv and the occupied territories. The operation was conducted using a hypersonic Palestine 2 missile. Sari stressed that Yemen's anti-U.S. and anti-Israeli operations will continue until the Zionist regime's ongoing genocide in Gaza stops and the siege of the territory is lifted. And with that, we'll come to an end for this additional World News. Thanks for being with us. This is bye-bye for now.
Diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The limelight. Reports say 50,000 pregnant women in Gaza are at risk. This is while Gaza's hospitals have lost 75% of their capacity. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, the director of the government media office in Gaza, Ismail al-Sawabta, says the Zionist regime has left 34 hospitals inoperable. Hospitals in the besieged Gaza Strip have lost 75% of their capacity amid Israel's devastating war, according to the director of hospitals at the enclave's Ministry of Health. Meanwhile, the UN Population Fund, UNFPA, has warned that 50,000 pregnant women are in danger, with 4,000 deliveries expected in the next month alone. Hospitals director Marwan Alham said the majority of hospitals in Gaza are now out of service, with only 5 still operating but at a limited capacity, the Middle East Monitor reported. He explained that doctors are operating despite a severe shortage of medicines that prevents them from treating thousands of patients. Alhams described the health situation in Gaza as catastrophic due to the severe shortage in all surgical departments, causing many of them to stop operating. For his part, director of the government media office in Gaza, Ismail al-Thababta, said Israel has left 34 hospitals inoperable. The UNFPA this week said, in addition to weakened immune systems and the risk of waterborne diseases, pregnant and breastfeeding women must also survive alongside piles of rubbish and sewage and with barely any access to healthcare. In these dire circumstances, there are around 50,000 pregnant women in Gaza, with 4,000 deliveries expected in the next month alone, according to UNFPA. Initial data indicate that in the last 6 months, there has been a sharp rise in reported miscarriages, the agency noted. UNRWA, the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees, also warned that heavy rains and limited aid worsen conditions for Gaza's displaced. Citing the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, UNRWA said 2024 is the deadliest year for humanitarians, with 281 deaths, mostly the UN agency's staff in Gaza. UNRWA earlier warned that thousands of families who fled the besieged areas are now sheltering in the cold and rain without blankets, mattresses and waterproof shelters. It stressed, the situation is beyond miserable. The agency said recently that Israel has denied 82 out of 91 attempts by the UN to deliver aid to the besieged northern Gaza Strip between October 6th and November 25th. It also impeded 9 other requests for life-saving humanitarian assistance to reach 3 specific areas in the territory, which has been under Israeli regime bombardment and a military siege for close to 2 months. Flouting a UN Security Council resolution demanding an immediate ceasefire, the Israeli regime has faced international condemnation amid its continued brutal offensive on Gaza. Currently on trial before the International Court of Justice for Genocide Against Palestinians, the Zionist regime has been waging a devastating war on Gaza since October 7, 2023. According to Gaza's Ministry of Health, at least 45,000 Palestinians have, to date, been martyred and at least 104,933 wounded. Moreover, at least 11,000 people are unaccounted for, presumed dead under the rubble of their homes throughout the Gaza Strip. Palestinian and international organizations say the majority of those martyred and wounded are women and children. The Zionist regime war has resulted in an acute famine, mostly in northern Gaza, resulting in the death of many Palestinians, mostly children. The Israeli regime aggression has also resulted in the forceful displacement of nearly 2 million people from all over the Gaza Strip, with the vast majority of the displaced forced into the densely crowded southern city of Rafah near the border with Egypt, in what has become Palestine's largest mass exodus since 1948 Nakba. Later in the war, hundreds of thousands of Palestinians began moving from the south to central Gaza in a constant search for safety.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello. The recent resurgence of terrorism in Syria, led by the Hayat Tahrir al-Sham group, began with a surprise offensive in late November targeting the city of Aleppo. This offensive has coincided with the Israeli regime's agreement to a ceasefire with Lebanon. The issue has sparked an important debate. Is Israel exacerbating the conflict by aligning with militant factions and terrorists? I am Bahman Nurai, your host, and in this edition of Spotlight, we delve into the multifaceted dynamics of Israel's involvement in Syria and its implications for regional stability. First, let us watch this report.
The recent resurgence of terrorism in Syria, led by the Hayat Tahrir al-Sham group, began with a surprise offensive in late November, targeting the city of Aleppo. This offensive resulted in the capture of several towns and villages, coinciding with the Israeli regime's agreement to a ceasefire with Lebanon. Far from being a coincidence, many believe that Israel is avenging its loss in Lebanon and Gaza through its support for the resurgence of terrorism in Syria. Just 48 hours before the Aleppo attack, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu warned Syrian President Bashar al-Assad not to provoke Israel, specifically regarding arms transfers to Hezbollah through Syrian territory. Over the past year, Israel has conducted more than 70 strikes in Syria, targeting border crossings deemed routes for arms transfer to Hezbollah, as well as the group's warehouses and facilities within Syrian territory. This illegal aggression has created an opportunity for terrorist groups to advance across the Arab country, particularly as the Lebanese resistance group Hezbollah is recovering from its recent war with Israel. Syria's support for the resistance front has long irritated Israel, which has occupied the Golan Heights since the 1967 war. This support was underscored in a speech by the late Hamas political bureau leader Yahya Sinwar.
For the construction of Quds Axis, we will reconcile with Assad's Syria, which is one of our key allies in the Levant. We will strengthen our relations with Hezbollah, which is the main arm in the Levant, and in order to expand the field of resistance in Yemen and Iraq, we need to broaden our relations.
Osama Hamdan, head of the international relations for Hamas, had also elaborated on the matter, highlighting the strategic importance of Syria for resistance groups.
The Syrian position that is clearly expressed is a position of support for the Palestinian people and their resistance, whether on the official level or on the level of Syrian media. But everyone knows what happened to Syria during the past decade, and this had an impact on Syria's abilities. We cannot forget the Syrian position and the Syrian effort over decades that have passed before the last decade. How Syria supported the resistance and how it stood by the side of the resistance and how it endured the support of the resistance. In this time period, we believe that what happened to Syria may not have allowed it to play the same role.
Syrian
Syria has time and again accused Israel of aiding terrorist groups like Hayat Tahrir al-Sham and highlighted the suspicious timing between Israeli airstrikes and subsequent terrorist attacks on government-held areas. The Syrian government had previously managed to defeat terrorist groups through coordinated military offensives and airstrikes, often with support from allies like Russia and Iran. Following the surprise terrorist attack on November 27, the government has now launched a robust counteroffensive to reclaim lost territories and eliminate terrorist threats.
Welcome back. Allow me to introduce my guests. Hafsa Kara Mustafa, journalist and political commentator from London. And Saib Shah, West Asia expert from Belfast.
The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the show. It is very great to have you and thank you for your time. Allow me to introduce Fit Hafsa first. Long time haven't seen you here on the program. How does the timing of Takfiri's insurgents in Syria correlate with the recent ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah, you think?
I think it's very related, and it confirms what many of us have been saying about these groups for over a decade, which is that they're part and parcel of the Israeli regime apparatus. They have consistently operated to serve Israel's interests. And I think nowhere has this been more blatant than this most recent attack on Halab. Now, I think it's important to remind viewers that over the past year, where we've seen absolute carnage in Palestine and in Lebanon, when we've seen over 70 mosques destroyed and flattened in Gaza, but also places of Christian worship, both in Palestine and Lebanon, these groups, these supposedly Muslim groups, these groups calling themselves Muslims, haven't lifted a finger to aid their fellow Muslim and Arab brothers very often, and yet today have been incredibly effective in destroying and attacking and weakening a predominantly Arab and predominantly Muslim country. So I think this is a confirmation of their status as part of the Israeli apparatus. And of course, the timing, as ever, has always coincided with Israeli interests.
Well, Saib, great to have you again on the program. We have heard it a lot that the Israelis believe that they have worn down resistance axis, Hezbollah and other parts of the resistance axis in the region. Do you believe, you know, what advantage can Israel gain from these rebel groups, these insurgent groups in Syria right now, the Takfiris and terrorists?
You'll allow me, we'll take a few minutes to explain that. First of all, these groups, I just want to say that to the Western media or linked media within in the region, designated the groups by the United Nations Security Council as terrorist groups, especially Jabhat Tahrir al-Sham and al-Nusra. Since the invasion of the United States of America to Iraq, and the list the Americans have in their hands, which is researched and edited by Netanyahu and the Zionist entity of leaders and country, the United States of America, got to destroy to secure the existence of the State of Israel, since these countries are supportive of the Palestinian and Lebanese resistance. In the top of the list was Syria. In 2004, the Syrians were threatened directly by George W. Bush to fall in line and to stop supporting the Palestinian and Lebanese resistance and to kick out the Palestinian presence in Syria from the resistance. Otherwise, he will be punished. Syria at the time, Colin Powell, who carried the message to Assad. Assad asked him to leave, and Assad stayed the course with the resistance. And we've seen after that, 2005, the Palestinian resistance managed to liberate Gaza and cleanse the Zionist entity out. 2006, then the United States of America gave order to the Zionist entity to invade Lebanon. They went with massive bombardment against Dahiya of Beirut, the suburb of Beirut, and then the land invasion. And they wanted to form kind of vice crib around from Lebanon around Syria, the Americans in Iraq and the Israelis through Lebanon. They were shocked to the core by the strength of the Belize resistance, who destroyed the Israelis' invasion at the time. And that that plan for the new Middle East again at that time is just being defeated. Since then, the United States of America brought these Takfiri groups during the Arab Spring to tackle all the regimes which they see they are not following the Americans' kind of doctrine in the region, and they are not allies of it, like Syria. Before that, of course, they took Iraq, and then Libya, and all of that. We see what these Takfiri groups done in Syria is unbelievable. But Syria stayed the course with the support of the Lebanese resistance, the Palestinian resistance, Iran, Russia as well. And that, the same itself, we seen after that 90% of the Syrian resources fell under the occupation, under American occupation, gas, oil, wheat, all of that. And we seen groups, these Takfiri groups, managed to steal and transfer through Turkey the Syrian gas and oil to the Zionist entity itself, where even less than 10% of the cost, they get the Syrian fuel to them. And this as well bring us to 24 right now, when the resilience of the Lebanese resistance and the Palestinians expose the weakness of this Zionist entity. And Netanyahu went in seeking for a ceasefire after the Black Sunday. The Black Sunday, when 4 million of the population and that entity went underground, and the port of Umm Sdoud near Gaza to Haifa in the north were dismantled by barrage and salvos of rockets. That shook Netanyahu, and he exercised some more pressure. He wanted that ceasefire. And then he came and warning Assad of playing with fire, since Syria was the hub of supplying the chain, the controller of the supply chain to the resistance, the research centers of the resistance in Syria, the manufacturing. Today, the Takfiri groups declared they captured around Halab, Aleppo, a complex of military complex for producing rockets and ammunition, which was used for supplying the resistance in Lebanon or in Palestine. So we know the target is the Zionist entity's security, in short.
Right, thank you. Now I'm going to go back to Hafsa. You know, you had what Saeb was telling us about the warning of Bashar al-Assad by Netanyahu 48 hours before the Aleppo strike. What do you think, you know, is the actual gain, you know, because we all know that Bashar al-Assad is a supporter and backer of resistance axis in the region and has never backed down in his support. You know, why Israel believes that it can actually gain something by supporting these terrorist groups right now in Syria? Because, you know, capturing and getting areas is one thing and holding to them is something else. I don't think they can hold on to those areas. What is the gain in there for Israel?
Well, I think first and foremost is obviously to weaken Syria as much as it possibly can. And of course, Syria is going to be distracted by this attack on its northern territory. So that's a reality that is undeniable. The other thing I think you have to acknowledge is that the Israelis, by doing this, are literally signaling to the Muslim world that they can activate supposedly Islamic cells any way and anywhere they want. They're literally coming out of the closet and recognizing that they can manipulate and they control these groups. So I think this is a way for Netanyahu to threaten the rest of the Muslim world, to tell them that they can unleash their dogs on the rest of the Muslim world as they please. And we've been saying this for many years. Many have called those who called out these groups as conspiracy theorists, or they've accused others of being sectarian because they're essentially Sunni Muslim groups. But the facts are now very telling. It is absolutely clear that these people work for Israeli interests. And Israel is now coming out and literally, quite literally, admitting to controlling these groups. And it's a way for Netanyahu to say, well, we have the power not only to attack, and of course we have the power of being backed by the United States, military power, but we also have the power to unleash these terrorist militias on any country that we please around the region. So I think this is a threat not only to Syria, but to the wider Muslim world, to tell them that these groups are actually under the control of Israel and can be activated as Israel pleases.
And Hafsa, how do you think the situation in Syria right now could kind of spill over to other regional countries? You know, because that is actually playing with the fire for regional countries who are kind of supporting this. How can they contain this within Syria?
Well, I think this should be a wake-up call for the wider region, because Netanyahu has implemented now, has started to work on his Greater Israel plan. He's been saying it, and now he's actually working on it. Now, the part of the plan includes going as far as way into modern-day Saudi Arabia. That's how far the Greater Israel plan goes. And I think that these groups have the power to aid Israel in going as far as. And so I think that Arab countries that have either been okay with Israel or have normalized with Israel, such as Dubai, Bahrain, etc., but also countries like Saudi Arabia, who have been in talks to normalize and who have not, momentarily suspended talks, but they are still planning on returning to the negotiating table with Israel in order to normalize relations. I think these countries, and in particular Saudi Arabia, which is quite large and important in the region, has the power to stop this. The fact that they don't, I think, would also go as far as confirming that within the Saudi monarchy, there are acquaintances with the Zionist regime. I think that's been a suspicion for long enough. But I think if they do not react to this incursion in Arab territory and to this blatant recognition that these groups do work for the Zionist regime, then they're preparing, if you will, the establishment of a Greater Israel, and they're confirming their complicity with Israel. So I think this is also a testing time for countries like Saudi Arabia to intervene and stop this, or aid Syria, or stop funding of groups that are associated to these Takfiri groups. Because actually, although today Syria is the main target for the obvious reasons that my colleague has stated, and of course their support of the resistance, I think the long-term plan of Israel is to widen their territory through these groups and aid in the creation of the Greater Israel plan.
Thank you, Hafsa. Very interesting that you mentioned the Arab countries in the region. Now, going back to you, Saeb, we had today the Arab League supporting Syrian government against terrorism, and they say that the Syrian government's sovereignty must stay put, and they supported Syria in this. We remember that in 2011, they all had the position and the stance against Bashar al-Assad in power. Why the change of position right now, especially we had UAE also in particular talking in support of Bashar al-Assad's government?
You see, at the time, Barack Obama, on the back of the Arab Spring, he brought two models to the region: the Pakistani military model, or the Turkish Islamic secular model. And he threw that, and the Arabs and the Ottomans run with that, which the new Ottoman, Erdogan and his gang, and started the Arab Spring, thinking with the backing of the Americans, they're going to bring back the Ottoman Empire. And the Zionists and the Americans were using the Takfiri groups and the fanatic religious groups and telling them, yes, you can have your pro-Western, of course, Islamic Khilafah in the area. The same thing was in 1954 when they tried to create what they called the Baghdad Alliance, which is part of the Cold War against, at the time, the Soviet Union against the Arab Liberation Movement, which we in the region answered that at the time with Bandung in Indonesia and start forming the third world countries wave of liberation against imperialism and independent line, non-alliance line with the West or with the East. And that continued. So today they try to bring that at the time of Obama with a new dress to put the whole region under control. Let's remember one fact. Syria as a government, as a state, is part of the Arab Liberation Movement, were developed in the 50s and the 60s. So Syria regime is came on the back as part of the Arab Liberation Movement, exactly like the Palestinian resistance at the time, came as anti-imperialist, anti-Zionist for the liberation of Palestine. The Ba'ath Party in Syria, a flag is the Palestinian flag. This is a state. So this country is targeted as part of the liberation movement, the resistance. Syria always entrenched in that. Since this is why you can see Arabic regimes, reactionary Arabic regimes, as my colleague rightly mentioned, Saudi and Gulf State and all of that, were using tons of money to bribe the survivors of the American attacks after the invasion of Iraq to line up with them against the wave of radical Arabic regimes, they said. They eliminated Gaddafi in Syria. They killed the man who was 100% behind the Palestinian resistance. They tried to do the same in targeting all the leadership in Damascus when they blew the security gathering at the time. Assad survived that attack. They threw mayhem and devastation in the region. They don't care how many millions being displaced and around the world cannot find refuge. Those Arabic countries, the Prime Minister of Qatar alone, he said, they invested in an article and an interview with the Qatari TV, not Al Jazeera, the official Qatari TV, said nearly 180 billion at the time Qatar is spent on in Syria. Imagine if you spend that much money in Syria to destroy it. If you spend that money in Asia and Africa alone, you'll make it a new tigers of industry countering the West. So this is the mentality, because they were directed, these states, by the United States of America and by the Zionist entity. The most important thing is to secure the existence of the Zionist entity, Israel. So these countries today, they are back. They seem they are weakened. A lot of the Muslim fanatic groups, especially like the Emirates or others. So they think aligning themselves right with secular state is better for them.
Thank you, Saeb. Now, getting back to Hafsa, you know, as Saeb just mentioned also, regional players. I'm going to also talk a little bit about that. But, well, you know, this operation that they had against Aleppo and Idlib, you know, it must have had months of training. It is not like they just woke up and did the operation. And it was surprising in matters of, like, the amount of land that they gained in a matter of days. What's, you know, we've had Turkey supporting anti-Israeli moves within the United Nations Security Council also. What's in it in Turkey in this? Because could we say that Turkey is also aligning with Israel in this matter in particular? And what's in it for them?
Well, I think Turkey has been an active player in this from the start. Definitely since the start of the attacks on Syria. It's played a major role. It supported the ousting of Gaddafi. It supported the ousting of Bashar al-Assad and has played an active role. It had at some point take a step back because, of course, within the region between, or the shared region between Syria and Turkey, you had the emergence of Kurdish group. And I think that Turkey felt threatened with that. So it needed to take a step back. But they have been working in destabilizing Syria from day one. We know that Erdogan claims to support the Palestinian cause in verbally, but of course, in terms of action, does nothing. he never even interrupted the relations. I mean, just very recently and very symbolically. But of course, we know that the oil that fuels the jets that are pounding Gaza and Lebanon as we speak actually transit through the pipelines that go through Turkey and get Turkish approval. So the role of Turkey is very blatant here. It's difficult to state. I mean, I don't think that Turkey envisaged a sort of the return of the Ottoman Empire. I think they're reasonable enough. But we're seeing the emergence of very bizarre groups. We've seen with the normalization of Israel through the Abraham Accords, the rise of what we can only describe as Arab Zionism. And now we're seeing a very strange alliance between Islamists and actual Kemalist groups. Based on the theories of Mustafa Kemal, who was an active Islamophobe. And so we're seeing an alliance between sort of Kemalo-Islamism that is born in Turkey out of this very racist and fascistic Turkish nationalism, allying with these Takfiri groups claiming to be Islamic. And I think that obviously it is designed to extend Turkish influence around the region and impose itself as a powerful player in the region. And the sad thing, of course, is that whilst Turkey plays the Muslim card, it is actually actively behaving and actively contributing to the weakening and the killing and the destruction of Muslim countries and therefore the death of Muslim people.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Hafsa. Thank you, Sayab, for your insights. Unfortunately, we just ran out of time. I would love to continue this conversation with you. It was a real joy. So thank you, Hafsa Kara Mustafa, journalist and political commentator from London, and also Sayab Shah, West Asia expert from Belfast. Again, thank you. This was another Spotlight. Thank you.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha
answering it down some questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman, Allah, who is Al-Mannan.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs with me, Atta, the host of this program. Sheikh Rouhani is over here to answer today's question. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
All right, for today's discussion, we want to talk about the creation of the man and women according to the Islamic beliefs. Sheikh Rouhani, the major question, and I believe this might be a superstitious question, but I have to ask it that. Okay, the woman from the first day was born out of, I don't know, for example, the left chest of the man or something like that. Or, for example, the women have been born from men at the first place. I know this might be a joke or a superstitious question, but what's your answer to that? Is it possible, or do we have any reference to such a story in our Holy Quran or Holy Texts of the Islam or not?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. First of all, we should know that what is important in our existence as man, as human beings, is the existence of soul, is the existence of nafs and ruh.
Mm-hmm.
That is the main essence of man, or the essential part of the existence of man. Man exists with the soul and lives with the soul, and after the death remains with the soul, and even before coming to this world existed with the soul and nafs and ruh.
Yes.
So that's why that ruh is essential. That ruh is the real or the true kind of existence of man.
Yes.
If that is the case, Islamically talking, in the Quran it is said that man and woman are made or are created from nafs in wahida.
Yes.
So if the nafs, if the soul from which they are created are nafs wahid, is one single source, one single nafs and soul, then there is no any superiority for man over women, for women over men.
Or for women being born from men at the first day.
That's not true.
That's right.
Because they are created from nafs and wahid.
That's right.
The nafs is immaterial. Nafs is not something physical, something bodily that you can say, for example, this part of nafs or that part of nafs.
Yes.
When nafs is completely immaterial or mujarrad or aqlani and rouhani, it has no any physicality, any, let's say, bodily kind of features. So that is why there is no any limitation in the existence of nafs. And then it means that both man and both Adam and Eve, both of them were created from this nafs and wahid. And they, from this spiritual or let's say immaterial aspect, which is the essential aspect of their existence, they are the same, they are equal, and there is no any superiority for any of them over the other.
Yes.
This is the first point.
So what do you mean by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that, for example, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has created a wife, for example, out of a husband for him or something like that?
You know, man and woman or spouse, if you consider this family life, man is a complementary creature for women. Women are like complementary creatures for men.
Okay.
They complement each other.
Yes.
Man without women is deficient, you know?
Yeah.
And women without man are deficient.
The ayah I was referring to, was وَخَلَقَ مِنْهَا زَوْجَهَا.
Yeah.
That's right.
So
this does not mean that a woman was created from man. No, it does not mean that.
Of course not. مِنْ نَفْسٍ وَاحِدٍ.
Okay.
They are created min nafsin wahid.
Yes.
But if, for example, if this bodily or physical things, created from something, it doesn't show any kind of superiority for something. Because the soul is important, the nafs is important, okay? Even if that is the case, then we cannot say based that the ayah on that ayah that man is superior than women or women are superior than men.
No.
We cannot say such a thing.
That's right.
In terms of being human, they are the same. They are in the same equal kind of status as being human.
All right.
But of course, there is a chance for some men to perfect themselves or women to perfect themselves.
Yes.
The more one is pious, the more he is close to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and he is the more superior. And that is something available for both men and women.
Do we have any explicit